Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard.
And he's Richard Munchkin. We have a little bit of audio problem with Richard, but we're going to make this work. Our guest tonight is poker player Andy Block, and we'll be talking mostly about the upcoming World Series of Poker. We'll be talking to Andy in a few minutes. All right, are you there yet, Richard?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
We can hear you fine, and you're live on the air. All right. So tomorrow evening, I'm going to be getting married to Bonnie. We're planning to go on a four-week European honeymoon, so we've been taping a lot of shows for the next 4 weeks, and it turns out we're going to have no honeymoon. Bonnie has health issues, and they don't want her to have a serious problem in the middle of the ocean. So we're going to be home, and we have five shows taped, so I'm not sure what order you're going to be getting them, but we're going to be fine. She's going to survive, and the marriage is going to go on. Those of you who are in town and wish to join us on bobdancer.com, on my blog this week, is an open invitation to everybody to go to a square dance reception tomorrow night. And if you're friendly to the bride and groom, you're definitely welcome.
I'm sorry I'm not going to be able to make it. I had fully intended to go to the wedding, and I'm called away now. I'm in pre-production on a movie, so I'm not going to be able to make it. So I wish you all the best. I hope you have a great time.
Thank you. What's true is Richard has a secret blackjack game in Texas that he's not telling any of us about. All right. Our guest tonight is Andy Block, former MIT blackjack team members, rock, paper, scissors champion, World Series of Poker bracelet winner. Andy Block, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Good to be here.
All right. First things first. You canceled last week because your wife was going into labor that day. So congratulations. Wife and baby doing fine?
Yes, they're doing fine. We're now home, and I was able to sneak out a little bit for this interview, but that's why I'm not in the studio.
Uh-huh.
Now, how is this going to affect your World Series of Poker coming up?
Well, my wife wants me to play because, you know, quite frankly, that's how I make my money. So if she's thinking long term, she definitely wants me to play. But I'm probably going to be skipping a lot more events than I have in the past. I played about 30-something events last year, and the last few years, I played about that many. And that's a lot of events. Yes, you can play 60-something events, maybe more if you're over 50 and female. But most people, like, even playing 30 events, that's like one event a day. And that's if you don't last it till day two or day three of some events. So hopefully, you know, I play very few events.
And she's fine with you being away that much?
Well, originally the baby wasn't planned to... The due date was a little bit later, like the day before the World Series started. So now I have a few extra days, I guess, to get everything okay. We're going to have some family here helping her out. So I'm going to be skipping a bunch of the smaller events, try to make sure I'm focused and rested up for the big ones, the 50K in particular.
Now, in the news recently, Guy Laliberté, the billionaire founder of Cirque du Soleil, claims he was regularly cheated on the Full Tilt poker site by well-known, though as yet unnamed, players who would apparently play with virtual bankrolls and gang up on him, forcing him to be making all-in decisions all of the time. The players would then chop up the revenues from La Liberté. Now, Andy, this has been all over the poker news in the last couple of weeks. What is your take on this?
I think it's going to pretty much blow over. I don't know the specifics, and Guy did not go and explain exactly what he meant. I mean, what kind of collusion is going on there? If he's just saying that, oh, these guys have unlimited money or more money than they would have ordinarily and then can put them all in, well, this guy's a billionaire. He could do that to them too. So I don't see how that can be collusion or unfair or anything like that. And I don't think the way a lot of these guys play is that they're even thinking about that they might go broke in a hand. They're willing to put it all in the line. So that kind of thing. I think, I don't know, there might be something going on there. Maybe he's really upset at how much he lost. And, maybe...
Well, he said that he felt they were sort of soft playing against each other and only playing, hard against him.
Yeah, if he had some hand histories or something to back it up. I mean, if he wanted to, he could just... If he has the hand histories on his computer, he might not have saved it. He could just send it to somebody on 2+2 or some other website that people trust, and they would go and analyze it and say yes or no that he's doing that. But I'm sure if he ever had those kind of complaints back when it was happening, he could have gone and brought it up with Full Tilt, and they would have gone and looked into it and given him an answer, yes or no.
Yeah, I wasn't, the article I read, I wasn't clear that it was just Full Tilt, but,
right.
I don't know.
It probably was whatever sites he was playing on. I mean, Full Tilt and PokerStars probably, I don't know if he played on any other sites. And the thing is, he hasn't singled out anybody, which is good, but it also means that people can't really defend themselves because they don't know what they're talking about. It's kind of, in law, you can't just make baseless accusations or you can't just make accusations without presenting facts, some facts that can be disputed. So, I mean, without saying anything like that. And the problem is it looks bad for everybody that he's played against. And he's never said everybody that he's played against has done it. So I just think I understand it. He lost some money online, a lot of money for average person, probably not a lot of money for him. But it's always embarrassing when you lose. Casinos hate to lose, and they, make billions of dollars. And I know, and Richard, you go into a casino and you beat them out of a few thousand dollars, just because you're smarter than them or whatever. They go and treat you criminals and accuse you of crimes that you've never committed. You're just using your brain. So I don't know what the case is here, but I don't think it's a wise thing to do to go make those kind of accusations publicly, without really having anything giving people a chance to defend themselves.
Do you think there's much cheating going on in high stakes poker in Las Vegas in the casinos?
Less cheating regards to what? In regards to the past or compared to online?
Well, I mean, 40 years ago, the stories are that their cheating was rampant. I mean, but I'm just wondering if you think that it's a lot less today, and is it something that you worry about in the live games in Vegas?
Yeah, it's something that's a lot less today. It is still something that I worry about. There's a million different ways that people could try to mark cards or collude or signal, and in live play, the casino, they might have a camera on the game, but they're not recording every hand. They can't see people's hole cards. They can't, they're not record. If they are recording any video, probably doesn't show the players, probably is focused just on the rack and the board, just to make sure the casino isn't losing any money. Nobody's stealing from the casino, because that's what they're really worried about. If it's online, the site has the full hand history and can see if there's anything kind of suspicious going on. I mean, that happened to me, where I thought I might have been colluding against, and colluded against, and you know, the site showed me that, to my embarrassment, that I, or you know, proved to me enough to my embarrassment that I was just playing badly and getting unlucky. So you know, that's really a lot of times people are just playing badly and or getting unlucky, and they blame it on cheating. But also, like, cheating can't always be ruled out, and you know, unfortunately, in live action, there's very little that they can do, and there's a lot of ways, probably just as many ways as online, or more ways that somebody can get cheated. And you just have to, you do have to be careful. Anything suspicious, the best thing to do is just pick up your chips and go to another table. You can try and keep an eye on the player. There's times I thought, there's actually times I caught people marking cards, or caught them and then sold the casino, and it took them like another 6 months to catch the guy and kick him out. But it does happen, and I have a, I guess, a reputation of being kind of a
whistleblower,
or whatever, for cards that are marked. A lot of times, cards get marked by accident by people that are being rough, looking at their whole cards, and they mark them with their fingernail when they're bending them up. But that's definitely
intentionally or unintentionally.
Well, that's a good question. I think there are definitely people that do it intentionally, and that was the guy that we caught at Foxwoods years ago. This was like maybe 10 years ago now or more, and he was doing it in tournaments, and he's doing it in the high-low split game. And I told him, he was sitting right next to me during part of the game and just being, and then I told almost everybody, and then he came back like 6 months later, and then they finally caught him on camera. But it's really hard to get the casino to catch them, and periodically at the World Series there'll be a lot of marked cards on the table, and it's usually in a game like low ball, where people are squeezing the cards, bending them up a lot. You know, usually I think I know, I can suspect, figure out who's probably doing it at the table, but you never really know, because if someone knows how to do it right, they can pretty much get away with it. But if you look at, like, what cheating really costs a player compared to, you know, other things, it's really going to be a small part of it. I mean, you want to make sure you're not get cheated big time. So, I mean, that's why you go to a casino, because it's more safe than playing a home game. But when you compare, like, for example, in the poker tournament, what the casino takes out of the tournament compared to, like, what in my wildest dreams I could, or nightmares, could be a cheater could be winning from the casino. You know, it'd be way better for us as poker players to band together and get the World Series of Poker to cut their tournament rate by like 25% than it would be to eliminate all cheating forever from poker. Because, I mean, that's really what the level is, I think it is. But, you know, when you do get cheated, it really hurts you. Especially, you know, if you get cheated for a long period of time for a lot of money, that can be kind of devastating. And I know for the Ultimate Poker, Ultimate Bet Poker, not Ultimate Poker, the Ultimate Bet days, there are some people that really had their lives practically ruined by how much they got cheated from that scandal.
Wow. You know, we've had a couple of sort of low to medium stakes players on the show recently. And one of the things that I've been really interested in is, you know, what win rates people can expect. And, you know, in the old days of limit poker, the figure of one big bet per hour was sort of a benchmark, you know. So if you played 20-40 and you made $40 an hour was what pros expected to make. Do you have a sense of what that would be for no-limit players? And how long a losing streak do you think you could go on and not think it was just a random fluctuation?
Yeah, for no-limit, so much of your win rate and your variance depends on like how aggressive and wild the other players are in loose. You know, to some degree that matters in limit too, but in no-limit, you're at a passive table and there's no pot to get above, like, you know, very few above like 10 or 20 big blinds. It's going to be hard to win or lose that much. So, like, comparing it to like the number of big blinds in live play isn't necessarily always going to be the, you know, the right way to compare it. But Yeah, you definitely, you want to, per hour, I would say probably 10 big blinds, maybe. I'm not really sure. It's been a long time since I've, I don't think I've ever actually played a lot of no-limit hold'em cash games in a casino, because when I was playing a lot of cash games in the casino, it was almost no limit. It was all limit, like you said. And, you know, one big bet an hour was a decent rate for a pro.
And how long do you think you could go, you know, how long do you think you – I mean, one of the reasons I ask this is because in my book, Kathy Holbert was a limit player, and she said that at one point David Sklansky had said that a limit player could lose for a year just because of bad fluctuations. And at the same time, Chip Reese said, you know, boy, I don't think I've ever lost for longer than 3 weeks. So
yeah.
So I'm wondering what you think for a no-limit player, what that range is.
It's probably similar for a no-limit player. Online, you get so many more hands in per hour, that, and you kind of play multiple tables. And live, you have other ways you can get an edge just by reading, you know, by reading the actual tells of your opponent rather than just their betting patterns. That if you're a good pro in a cash game and you're putting in the hours, you're playing 2,000 hours a year or 1,000 hours a year or whatever it is, or 4,000 hours a year, how, depends how crazy you want to get, you should be winning out of the every year, no question about it. If you're playing a cash game, if you're playing like super high limits where your edges are really thin, I mean, that's a different story. But then, like, maybe you're choosing the wrong games. Maybe you should be sitting out sometimes, because sometimes you can be in a game with a really big fish, and everybody at the table, even though, like, the average players at the table, they're going to earn like a bet or two per hour, a big bet or two per hour in the limit games, and or more. And if you're playing, if you're spending a lot of times playing when you don't have those fish at the table, then, you know, you should probably be playing less. So if you're playing 2,000 hours per year and sometimes some years you're losing, you probably should only be playing 1,000 hours per year.
Now, you really don't play cash games anymore? Is that true or not? Are you mainly just playing tournaments?
Yeah, well, for the last year or so, I'm mainly just playing tournaments, and mainly just the World Series of Poker. I've been working on some other things, some inventions that have nothing at all to do with poker. So I've kind of used that as an excuse to stay out of the casinos. And I barely played any poker since the last World Series, maybe like one or two tournaments.
Do you worry about being sharp? I mean, it seems to me that you have to play all the time to stay sharp at a game.
There is some concern that, I have been playing a long time, and some degree, it's kind of like a bicycle. You might be a little bit off balance for a second, but then you pick it right back up. I'm not going to jump right into the 50K championship, but part of that is that it's in June 22nd, so I have like three to four weeks to prepare myself with some of the $1,000 events. To some degree, though, like, I'm almost better off not playing some of these other tournaments, because I'm still thinking about, like, last World Series of Poker. I'm in, like, the same frame of mind, poker-wise. And sometimes I think, well, I do worse when I've been playing too much poker leading up to the World Series and don't start to rethink, because the player base and the type of tournaments that you have in the World Series is way different than you get the rest of the year. You don't have, like, yeah, 1,000-player Omaha high-low tournaments the rest of the year, but you get tournaments like that at the World Series. And so, one great way is to go online and play, although there's a lot of – it's pretty limited right now, the legal sites in Nevada. There's only two or three sites, and the kind of action that they have isn't always really enough to get good practice at it. I have been thinking a lot about poker and what I can do to, like, improve my strategy and to, you know, just get back to the level that I was playing at last year.
So do you go practice online in Nevada in those low-stakes games?
I might go and practice a little bit. I did play a little bit last year. I don't think I've played at all this year. I did play on WSOP and on Ultimate Poker, and found way too many bugs and way too many things that it didn't do right. It's just a little bit frustrating when like poker has gone back 10 years. Online poker has gone back 10 years in Nevada, and you know some of these things that they figured out years ago, and they were like poker issues too. Like the things tournaments weren't players weren't moved right in tournaments, and some of some simple things that people might not realize, like they had like a double bet in stud high low, for example. Things like that unless you really understand and know poker, some things that are easy to fall through the cracks, but there are other issues that were just, I couldn't believe that they started a site with some of these bugs in their software.
It did seem crazy to me that they would try to, you know, reinvent the wheel and write poker software from scratch when there were so many good softwares that already exist that have been doing it for, you know, 10 plus years.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I wish they had bought out an existing site that was in Europe that had great software. The WSOP does have another company that has been doing it for like 10 years, but even their software had a lot of issues in it.
And, really?
You know, I can't believe how many issues I found on the WSOP site. A lot of which have probably been fixed by now, but it's still, there's no excuse when you know, a name that's almost synonymous with poker tournaments, when you can have a site like that didn't, like, move people, balance tables, had the bug with the stud high low, and you know, I had, like, a list of, like, 50 things that were wrong or at least frustrating with the site.
Now, several World Series of Poker players regularly make side bets as to things such as, will you win a bracelet or not this year? Or between you and this other guy, who will last longer in a particular tournament? Have you ever made such bets in these tournaments, and do you expect to do it this year?
Yes, I have made such bets, and I wish I hadn't. Although, I think overall, there's one bet that I made that I'm still waiting to get paid on, and it was basically settled 2 years ago, but I'm giving the guys a lot of slack because there was a little bit of confusion over the bet on his end, but I've still been, you know, we've been pretty much settled up, but I'm still waiting to get paid. Hopefully I get paid before the World Series, and I can use that money towards entering as many tournaments as I can, or as I feel like playing, given that I kind of want to be home a lot.
What was the bet? So, was it just to last longer? Or?
Yeah, well, it was one of those, you know, winning bracelet bets. I did make a couple of bets a few years back against Phil Ivey. Won and some and lost some, and overall lost money. I did have a bet where he was still in the main event, and I think he had, like, I don't remember exactly what he had, 1/500 from the chips or something, and offered him like 200-1 to win the main event or something like that for like $10,000. So I was on the hook for $2 million the year that he made the final table if he won the main event.
and you had 4 months to worry about it as he...
Yeah. But I really wasn't too, well, I was kind of worried at the time. I was trying to, like, negotiate with him to settle the debt beforehand, but we didn't end up coming to any terms. And, you know, luckily, and I was sweating it from the East Coast, and it was, like, 2 a.m, and I finally gave up and went to sleep. And he must have busted out right when I went to sleep. Because, you know, when I woke up, I found out that he had busted out like 7th or 6th or whatever it was. So I was actually hoping, I wanted him to go a little bit further, but I didn't really want to sweat it. So I was hoping I would wake up and find out he busted out 4th.
Did you?
No, I hear that Daniel Negreanu and Phil Ivey have teamed up and are offering even money that one of them will win a bracelet this year. And my understanding is Daniel plays like a bajillion events if he can. I mean, if you had to bet that at even money, which side would you take?
That's a really close one, and you have to look at all the events that are in the World Series this year, 65 events, and how many of them, all these 10K events, plus there's a million-dollar event again. So, you know, you're not going to have a huge field in a lot of these events. So, and if you look back historically over the history, I think since they started playing, I think they would have been close. They might have. They might be up like seven out of 13 times if you made that bet. They would have won. Of course, you know, the World Series the last few years, they haven't done that quite that well. But it's, you know, this year with the big one again, and with all of these 10K events that they added back in, I wonder if one of them will put up 10K to play the ladies event.
I would be really surprised if Negreanu did that. Very much surprised, as he's such a outspoken critic of things that are shady in his opinion. It would seem hypocritical. I would be extremely surprised if he did that.
I would be too. I'm not necessarily a fan of eliminating a whole class of people from playing a tournament, and I think there's also a lot of gray areas and a lot of legitimate reasons that men might want to play that event. But I still don't think that I personally probably would never play that event, but I might. I mean, if I really was that passionate about the issue, I mean, I think there should be a ladies event, but I think the way that they're handling it is wrong. The way that they're handling that, whether men can play the event and then, you know, pretending like it's a 10K event and giving a 90% discount, that to me, I really wonder if someone wanted to challenge that legally, whether that would hold up in court.
I see.
So that's the way they keep the men out of the event, is they say it's a $10,000 event, but if you're a woman, you get a 90% discount, and if you're a man, you don't? Is that the way they're handling it?
Right. That's the way they're handling it, and they think that's legal, or, you know, they think that nobody will challenge it anyway, because in Nevada, you can have, like, a ladies' night where ladies get a discount. So you can't, like, exclude one gender, but you can go and give one a discount. But I think a court would look at that and just laugh and say, hey, that's not a discount. That's a completely different rule. And like I said, I think there are a lot of legitimate reasons for people to want to play that event. And there's also, you know, and I also don't like how in the past when there were men that played that event, some of them had legitimate reasons, but say their wife or their girlfriend was playing in the event and really wanted them to play the event with them for whatever reason. Or, you know, imagine your grandmother is sick in the hospital and wants you to play the event for her, and you're going to play the event for breast cancer. Or you come into Las Vegas to play the event on Thursday, and your flight gets delayed, and you get in, and the only event that you can play is the ladies' event. I mean, these are just a few ideas. Or, you know, of course, there are transgender and transsexual and you know, all these issues. And you know, I mean, what are they going to do, make somebody drop their pants in the registration line? I mean, come on. That's kind of ridiculous. You want the discount, you have to strip. They're not going to do that. And that would be offensive to everybody. So I think if somebody really wanted to play the event and they have their own reasons to play it, you know, unfortunately, there are going to be some men that are going to abuse it and just say, oh, I'm going to play it because I think it's a juicy event. But there are other so many other events to play, and you can go play in another casino. So, you know, they're just, a lot of them are just doing it to prove a point, too.
And you see,
how many different games do you think you play? I mean, besides No Limit Hold'em in these various events?
I've played just about every game that they offer at the World Series, and I've cashed, I think, in almost in every game or almost every game, except for maybe the games that are only like one part of a 10-game mix. But I cashed in low ball in the pot limit Omaha, and deuced obviously in the Poker Players Championship, no limit, pot limit. So, and of course, like all these tournaments and different structures, the one game I haven't gotten to play yet is the no limit hold'em with no antes. And I've just been playing a different tournament both times that they've had that, both last couple of years. But I haven't gotten.
How does that work?
One.
No ant. How does that work? No ante.
Oh,
you mean they have no blinds?
Wait, there's ante, no blinds. I think. Is that it? Or,
oh, ante.
Yeah,
no
ante, no blinds. That's it. No. If it was no ante, it would be pretty much the same as pot limit hold'em with just, you know, one extra thing. But ante only, no limit hold'em. And, you know, so there's some interesting things you would do to play that game, that tournament. Like, you might just limp in early position because the minimum bet is the size of the ante. So if you want to play, you should put up a quarter. And I think if you're in first position, it might be right to put up a quarter almost no matter what. And then even if you have, like, two aces, so, you know, let somebody else go and raise it, and then you can re-raise it and jam it afterwards and disguise your hand a lot. So that's probably a great tournament because I don't think anybody really knows how to play it, and nobody's really been, like, analyzing the game too much because, hey, it gets played once as a tournament anyway, once a year at the World Series. So I usually do pretty well in those kind of games that are kind of new and you have to use a lot of intuition, and you can't just go from experience.
The one-drop million-dollar entry fee. Last I heard, it was about three-quarters full. There was a number of pretty famous names in there. Phil Ivey, Phil Gaffon, Jason Mercieres, Vanessa Selps, Eric Seidel, Antonio Fondiari, among others. Any chance we'll see Andy Block's name on that list?
Well, I'm going to play because Richard's putting me in.
Is that right? With all the money he's earning in this secret game in Texas, huh?
Right. Why do they limit the number of players they can join that? I don't understand that.
I don't get that either. I think they just want to make it – well, they want to limit it for TV or space or whatever. I think it's kind of ridiculous that they would limit it. I mean, how many more people are they going to have by leaving it uncapped? Not that
plus
many
to
more.
Right, and plus to you know, not get that extra $100K a person for the charity, yeah, it just seems crazy for all reasons to limit it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I can understand, like, pretending that there's a limit, and then, like, once you get close, be like, oh, we're going to add another table kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, because that gets people to, like, feel like they have to sign up in advance or something, but you could also just, you know, offer somebody an advantage. Not a chip advantage, but, you know, you sign up in advance and you get a free room for a week, or you get, like, whatever prompts or whatever you need to, like, convince people to sign up in advance. And
what kind of comp would you need to convince you to put up $1 million?
Well, if you know you're going to put up $1 million, right? If you know you're going to play it anyway, what do you need to say in advance that you're gonna do it and, like, put up? I don't know if these people that have committed to it have put up $1 million. I doubt it. I don't know what you have to do to reserve a seat. I mean, normally for a tournament to reserve a seat, you got to put up the buy-in, but that's kind of that's kind of expensive to put up $1 million. You're losing the interest that you could earn on that, even though it's not going to be a ton. But even if it's like 0.1%. That's $1,000 not by buying in.
Well, it would be 0.1% a year, and you.
No, I'm just saying if it's 0.1% for the length of period of time that you did it. But if it's like 1% a year, that would be $10,000 divided by however many months that you did it. I mean, it's thousands of dollars if you bought in early. What are they giving people?
If you had to post the entire thing, which I doubt,
right.
I really doubt
right.
You have to post
right.
It.
I highly doubt it. I'd imagine, like, the people that have played in the past, you know, or whatever, you put in some percent. I haven't even looked at it because, you know, honestly, if someone wanted to put me in, I would love to play, and we can negotiate how much I get. But
that person
yeah,
has.
I mean, I might even push play for the bracelet. I get to keep the bracelet, Fastlane. Although you might want to give me some small percentage, otherwise I might end up being the bubble boy. But the it's, you know, for almost everybody who's playing it, it's above their bankroll. But a lot of those people that are playing it have other people that are backing them. You have the billionaires that are playing it, and for them, this, it's nothing, especially since a lot of the money goes to charity. For a lot of the other players, though, like even if you won, if you had a choice, if I won a satellite and I had a choice of $1 million or be play this event, it'd be a tough decision. I might play it just because it's such a big event, and you know, to win it would just be, you know, huge for my career and et cetera. But from a bankroll standpoint, especially like a cash bankroll standpoint, probably not justified for almost anybody. I mean, what kind of bankroll do you really need to play this event? Even if like your expectation is like $500,000, you still need like $20 million bankroll or something to be able to play an event like that big. If you're betting according to, you know, your bankroll.
What bracelet would be the one you would like to win most? Is it the Players' Championship or the main event?
Well, I'd rather live the main event, but the chance of that happening is, like, I don't even dream about winning the main event anymore. There was a point in time in my poker career, like 15 years ago or more, when I thought, like, oh, if I play long enough, I'll probably win the main event. And that's back when the main event was, like, 300 players.
Yeah.
And now when it's, like, 6,000 players, you don't even think that. If I play long enough, maybe there's some chance I might make the final table. Maybe.
Well,
and that's, like, if it doesn't end up being, like, 50,000 players or something, then eventually.
You're just planning on dying too early. If, as long as you live to be 2,000 or 3,000 years old, I don't see a problem here.
Yeah, that's absolutely... Yeah, but I think I'd probably be living longer than the World Series of Poker is around. Maybe not, but I don't know. But other than that, obviously, like, the Players' Championship, I've come in second and third and 15th and 16th out of the 7 years I've played. So that's always a big event. That's one that I really don't want to miss. And every other year I've cashed in the event. So this is, and on the even years, and this is an even year, so I think I'm guaranteed at least 16th place.
Guaranteed? That means you're willing to put up really great odds in terms of guarantees? This this is great. I mean, we might do some business here. All right.
Yeah.
Now, I'm definitely not willing to bet against you even money. But as long as it's a guarantee, then that's like, you know, you're paying $1 million to 1 because, you know, or something, because you're guaranteeing it. Anyway, now, we did mention your name earlier this year with respect to the blackjack ball. You were one of the 5 finalists, which was an excellent achievement. And then you blew out really early on a card memorization test. As you departed, Max Rubin suggested you call up MIT and ask for your tuition money back. Although it was a funny line, since you have 2 degrees from MIT and a law degree from Harvard, that hardly qualifies you as being the dummy in the room. Now, do you have any explanation for what happened at that blackjack ball tournament?
Yeah, well, I dumped it on purpose because I wanted to get my tuition money back.
Ah, that's what happened.
No, what happened is I had a brain fart. I basically, it was, to explain to everybody, this was, Max had dealt out a deck of cards face up, or just spread out a deck of cards face up, and there were 4 of us there, and I was in the 3rd seat, and you had to remember, and whoever's the first one to get it wrong was out. So I realized, oh, I only have to remember every 3rd card, because I'm in the 3rd seat.
Every 4th card.
Every 4th card, exactly. I had a brain fart, and instead of remembering like the 3rd, the 7th, the 11th, I remember, it made it harder on myself, I remember the 3rd, the 6th, the 9th, the 12th, 15th,
et cetera. Uh-huh.
So I made myself remember like 17 cards, or tried to, instead of just 13 cards. And then when the player to my right announced my card, I was like, oh, crap. I got to guess now and hope someone screws up somehow the next round. So, that was kind of embarrassing.
All right. How did your request for tuition money go?
Yeah, I haven't asked them yet. So, hoping that they don't listen to this show.
I actually don't know if they do or not. I would.
Is your wife involved in gambling at all?
My wife was the chip counter for the World Series of Poker and for a poker site called PokerWire.com that's no longer around, and for the World Series of Poker. And so she was known as Jen the Amazing Chip Counter. But she hasn't really been doing any of that. She did cash in the World Series of Poker seven-card Raz event the first year she played it. So if you Google her, that will come up.
Wow, that's impressive. When you had this potential $2 million loss to Phil Ivey coming up, does she sweat the money more or less than you sweated it?
Yeah, I think she sweated it a little bit more than me. I definitely shouldn't have made the bet. I think it was around the par value of the bet. Maybe I was taking a little bit of the worst of it, but definitely given the variance, I should not have taken the bet. But, people were overvaluing Phil Ivey at the final table, and I think that was one of the reasons I was able to make a deal with him. He was pretty low on, relatively low on chips, and whatever whatever his bet was, whatever the odds against him were at the books was not justified. So I could have gone and like bet on Phil Ivey on some of the made a bet on Phil Ivey to kind of hedge myself, but I didn't see it being worthwhile at all, even though like I could have lost $2 million.
Yeah, easy come, easy go.
Yeah.
All right.
These projects that you're doing outside of poker, are these gambling related or is this something completely different?
Completely different from gambling. It involves shaking things up and chemistry and levitating particles and things like that.
Okay.
All right. Doesn't sound quite like blackjack. All right.
No.
So I'm going to run a few commercials while Richard is thinking up a few more questions to ask you after we get back from the commercials.
Okay.
All right. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than everyone else. At the Palms, they have 7 p.m. drawings each Friday night in May. You need to swipe your card before 6:45, but you do not need to be present to win the drawings. Each week's $10,000 is given away to 10 winners. Top prize of $4,000. All right. They have PFP, Play for Points, Monday through Friday. And what you can earn are Costco gift cards at a rate of 0.25% for video poker or 2% for slots. VideoPoker.com remains the best place to practice a wide variety of games, including Quick Quads, Ultimate X, Extra Draw Frenzy Poker, Hyper Bonus, and others. Often these games are the best returning games in a casino, and you need to practice to make sure you know how to play. The weekly contest for this week are 100 Play Draw Poker, Double Super Times Pay, and Extra Action Poker. Extra Action Poker, that's a triple play game, but it costs you 10 coins per line rather than 5. And you get 12 stud hands every time you get one or more aces. So if you're dealt one ace, then you play that triple play, but you get 12 stud hands starting with an ace. So if you're dealt, for example, a pair of fives, a pair of fours, and an ace, in most games you hold the two pair. And either you get the two pair or a full house. And you get the 12 stud hands, starting with one eighth. Now, you do get paid 4,000 coins if you get either royal flush or a straight flush, or 1,000 coins if you get any four of a kind, but you're starting with one eighth. Now, of course, if you're dealt four aces, then you get four aces on each of the 12 stud hands for a 1,000 coins each for 12,000 coins, plus whatever you get in the standard game, and how much you get for four aces on dealt in triple play depends on the game. But it's the lights are going to go off, and certain casino managers will be upset. Double Super Times Pay is like Super Times Pay, except there's two times you can earn the bonus. The nice part about the game is there is no strategy variations from the regular game. And there's at least two casinos where I have played that game, and I felt that was the best game in those particular casinos. So it's a good game to kind of be aware of. All right, Richard, I have given you 5 minutes to come up with more questions for Andy. What do you got?
It was 3 minutes, but so you live in Las Vegas. Do you ever feel the urge to head out and go to the Bellagio or the Aria and sit down and play in any of those cash games?
Yeah, well, the cash games can, you know, sometimes you read stories and there's a lot of action. If I wasn't working on all these other projects, I definitely want to go down there and play. But, you know, right now I need to focus a lot more of my time and my cash too on these other things. So I kind of like resist the urge. The big thing though is like, if I want, you don't really want to just go and like jump in these games, because they're playing a lot of other mixed games or you know, there's the kind of players in the game that you might not be used to playing. So if I were to go and try and play at the Aria or the Bellagio or wherever, in these biggest games, I'd really want to commit to it. I wouldn't want to just say, oh, I'm just going to take a shot this weekend and see what happens. Something that you want to commit to and really, really focus on whatever kind of games that they're playing.
So it wouldn't just be a one-night thing. It would be, I'm going to focus on this game and really work on extracting some money out of it.
Right, exactly. I wonder what, I don't know exactly what games they're playing there. I mean, they're playing like some like 15-game mix and stuff like that sometimes in the mixed games. And then, you know, the huge games, it depends who's in town and who's where. Like sometimes they have the big game here in Vegas, and sometimes it's in Macau, and sometimes it's, you know, wherever people are. So, you know, that I don't really have a bankroll right now, at least cash-wise, to go and play a game like that. And the other games, I've been thinking about it. I need to figure out a way to make some money in between World Series, but I haven't. Is that a word? World Series? I don't know.
No, it's three words.
What about the bracelets in these other World Series events? I mean, do you sort of look down your nose at people who have World Series bracelets from other than the World Series in Vegas?
I think the main events that they had in these places, those are definitely should count or could count as a World Series bracelet. Some of these other smaller events, I kind of question whether they should count, at least not the same. I mean, if you have like 100 players or fewer than 100 players, in a sense, it's sort of like in the old days. So should those bracelets count? But not everybody has the time or the desire to go and chase around the world all the bracelets. Now, the World Series has changed how they're doing the WSOP Europe and WSOP Asia Pacific. They're now only doing them on every other year. So I think this year is a WSOP Europe and no Asia, none in Australia, and then next year it'll be opposite. So they're making it a little bit easier for people to travel. I think if I was still traveling a lot, if I didn't have a daughter now, I'd probably be happy about it and be traveling around and playing all these events. But if you're not on the tournament trail, it makes it hard. You're just going to fall behind in the bracelet race because you just can't. It's just so time consuming and expensive potentially to go and to travel just for, you know, a few tournaments. It'd be one thing if they had 60 tournaments, although that could get pretty draining if they had 60 tournaments three times a year all around the world.
Yeah, that'd be like full time work.
Yeah, I might as well get a job. maybe not.
Now, what about blackjack? You ever have any urge to, as you're walking through the casino, you notice a bunch of small cards on the layout?
Yeah, I always have the urge, but I know I won't last very long. And I'm kind of like jealous of Ben Affleck and how he got to play such high limits for and win so much money. I wish I kind of had a piece of that.
Well, I really love the fact that he did do it. Well, but he won that money. I mean, the story they keep talking about, the $800,000, I thought was like 12 years ago or something. And I don't even know that he was playing a winning game when that happened.
Well, someone definitely recently that he just played there. And, I mean, I know a little bit more about it than was reported, but I'm not going to report the details that I know because I think it was sent to me in confidence. But... it was definitely recently, and it seems like he's no longer welcome to play blackjack at least the Hard Rock for the time being. I mean, it could be nice. Maybe they'll set some conditions or something for him to play where they think that he's not winning enough for them to worry about it. I think it could be potentially great publicity for them if they say, hey, okay, we've changed your mind. You can come and play here, but you know, here are the rules.
I read
something
today that they had changed their mind.
And well, that's great. I mean, that's what they should do.
Yeah, and supposedly, he's filming Batman right now in Detroit, and I hear that he's playing a lot there in Detroit and Motor City. So, I just thought he had such a tremendous opportunity that, I think that a lot of money could have been made with just some more creative thinking about how to approach it.
Yeah, I agree, although we don't really know the details. I mean, what I've heard is only part of it, and, you know, what's been reported, the details, it's still hard to tell, where, you know, you have some people that might not even know what they're talking about claiming that he went from, like, 100 to 60,000 or whatever it is, like, crazy bet spread that he might have done. But... was he like splitting tens? Was he doing other things? You know, the casino might not even realize, you know, if he had an edge or how much of an edge he had. He probably had an edge. I know he knows about card counting, obviously. I've actually given him a copy of my DVD. He actually told me he was really upset that he lost or someone absconded with the first copy I gave him. So, and I saw him later on, and he asked me for another copy, which I had. I don't know if he's watched it, but I know he actually had a copy in his hand.
Well, maybe when he loses it, he'll give you another one. Well, when you win your first or second Academy Award, Andy, maybe then you can get these kind of treatment at Hard Rock as well.
Yeah, maybe.
All right. So we only have a few seconds left. We've been talking to Andy Block. Congratulations on fatherhood, and good luck in the World Series. And thank you, Richard. I'm Bob Dancer. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.